civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
These two gentlemen at the front, Martin and Peter, they've been recording many of our talks for a few years now, and other people's talks, and putting them out online under the information website. So thank you, you're doing a really grand job. But they also have a printed journal. Now this is stuff that was printed originally some years ago, but it's now all been reissued. And there's amazing stuff, stuff about all kinds of things to upset you. Lunar conspiracy and, well, I haven't read it yet, but I'll tell you when I've read it.
It's all new content, Andy.
All new content?
Yes,
oh, it,
it's
well,
resuming the same subjects, but it's all
revisiting
new
the old
subjects. Yeah, revisiting, yeah.
So listen, there's a pile of them on the table at the back. And there's a little sort of donations box, you know, so if you take one, make a donation to the box, and well done. Because the more this stuff gets out there, the better, and people like Martin and Peter, they're doing a great job, and they're getting the information out there, hence good name, The Information. And that's what we're trying to do here as well, so yeah, do have a look as you go out there. So, I think we'd better begin. Oh no, one last thing, Marcus Allen, wave. Marcus has got Nexus magazine and various interesting books also on the table there. If you're new to Nexus magazine, why? And here's your chance to buy a copy and find out what's really going on in the world. Okay, it's time, I think, to introduce our speaker to you. So, Helen and I were at an astrological conference last year, and we got talking with Fionn Rawnsley. Got to get the name right here. And we realised he has something really interesting to share. And Fionn, if you've read the spec for tonight, you'll know he's worked in TV and as an artist and as a designer. But Stonehenge is a particular subject that is currently firing him up. And I think we're going to hear some new things today about Stonehenge. And, you know, we've had a history here of always trying to get new ideas out and get people along and talk about new stuff. So what you're getting tonight is the debut, I believe, of this material. So that you heard it here first, and hopefully it will not be last either. So it's brilliant that you've come along. Thank you. I'm going to hand you over, and a big hand please for Fionn. Thank you very much.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, everybody. Okay, I'll try.
The mic needs to get slightly more into the microphone.
All right, more microphone, make you speak to the microphone. Okay, so I've got to learn to use this gadget. It is on, isn't it?
We're hearing it well.
Yeah, okay. So, this evening, I'm going to talk about Stonehenge in the main, but I've got a few things to cover initially. And I'm going to have to lay in groundwork and assume that a lot of you probably, you know, don't know much about this sort of thing. And so if I'm a bit ponderous and talking about something you already know about, then please forgive. And if I sound too definite and too emphatic about something and it gets right up your nose, then okay, I'm sorry. But I've been studying this for about 20 years. And in fact, Andy's invitation here gave me a huge impetus to put this together. And it's been, I've put in a lot of work over this last year to actually concisely articulate it. So here we go, anyway. So basically, from what I've found is from the far reaches of the Antarctic, in the deserts of Australia, Africa, South America, and Turkey, including Göbekli Tepe, and Northern Europe to England. There seems to have been one sacred tradition of hidden from human eyes, is basically astro-terrestrial correspondence. Now, that's basically, it's a reflection of the skies onto the Earth. So what we're talking about, and I'll be talking about all the evening, is to do with large pictures set into the landscape, far bigger than you and I could conceive. And strangely, that means they're out of our realm. It's to do with images that the gods themselves may have seen, if they were gods, if they still are gods. Okay, so Stonehenge, Stairway to the Stars.
machine.
To a pointing at the machine, okay. Okay, so my story begins with Dr. John Dee, who I'm sure many of you will be aware of. And he was Elizabeth I, England's mathematician and her astronomer, royal. And he was an alchemist and a philosopher. And he collaborated with Mercator, who was the fellow who developed the Mercator projection of the spherical Earth. It's always been a great problem to get the Earth's spherical form, or the skies for that matter, into a flat map. And there were lots of different attempts at doing this. And he was involved in the very early sort of stages of developing that, I believe. And he said this, which was very interesting. It's found amongst his writings. He says, the stars, which agree with their reproductions on the ground, lie upon the celestial path of the sun, moon, and planets. With the notable exception of Orion and Hercules, all the greater stars of Sagittarius fall in the hindquarters of the horse, while Altair, Tabazed, and Alshain from Aquila do fall on his chest. Thus is astrology and astronomy carefully and exactly married and measured in scientific reconstruction of the heavens, which shows that the ancients understood all which today we learn it, know to be facts. So there he's talking about the area of the landscape around Glastonbury, that he must have been in some way able to envisage that it was drawn out as a sort of reflection of the heavens. And then we have Mrs. Maltwood. What I'm doing here is I'm introducing you to the precedent for the existence of these patterns in the landscape. So Mrs. Maltwood, there she is, lovely painting, and something that she made herself, which is like, she called it the Round Table of the Stars. And it's even got kind of place settings, if you like. She envisaged this as King Arthur's Round Table. And there it is. I found it very hard to understand myself. And she's got a great following. And she left several million dollars when she died in 1961 to a university in Canada. And all her works. She wrote several books about the Glastonbury Zodiac. And there's the Picadrix, which is an ancient grimoire about how to make a talisman using astrological magic. And it describes the principles which one might use to lay out an astrological city. Using astrological magic to invoke the benefits of the planets. And so I'm moving on now to my own early research. And working with Norwich and Jerusalem as parallel cities, what you see here is, on the left here, is an early map of Norwich, I think about 1900s. And my early experiments with looking at it as an astrological layer. And it actually works really well. And this is what really began to drag me into the fascination with the subject. And so I was looking at that, and you can see that in this image, I've laid a trace over the top, and I've drawn in various constellations like Hercules, and Draco the Dragon, and the Plough. And it's in simple sort of point-to-point sort of astrological diagrams. And I was really struggling with identifying constellations in the sky and on the ground. I was kind of, so what are the shapes? What shapes should they really be? I wasn't really sure about this. So this is the sort of thing I was looking at. And so, what's a constellation? How's that work? And so they don't even look like is this Orion? I mean, how do you get an idea of what a constellation is? And actually, there are lots of ways to envisage constellations. They've become, in more recent years, less and less visual, less and less pictorial. And the early ones, in the 1700s and going back to the 1500s, were beautiful and very pictorial. but these early ones. So I was trying to identify the stars, and I used to go outside with a black drawing book and on a starry night with a gold pen, and I used to just catch glimmers of the marks I was making, and I used to try and draw constellations with this gold pen catching the reflection on my black page. So it was kind of confusing. Then I'd go into the light and I'd go, oh, that's kind of disappointing. Anyway, so this is an Etruscan extispice model. It's basically a model of a liver. And it was almost standardized for the Etruscans. And they were always used by the Romans in laying out city plans. And on the right there, you've got the Babylonian words that relate to particular areas of the liver. It's called, for instance, this thing, it's called bladder, and this is a kind of pyramid thing. And each section was devoted to a different constellation, so to a different god. And so each part of it was a very sort of would give the information. The scryer would basically slaughter an animal at a particular location. If they were thinking of building a city, they'd slaughter the animal and they'd pull its liver out fresh, and it would be glinting and steaming. And you can imagine it's a very dark thing, and it would actually be reflective. So it would be actually kind of reflection of the heavens. So it's like a little mirror. And they look into it and they say, oh yes, the gallbladder's a bit distended. I'm not sure it's a good place to build our city here. And they'd really be able to sort of analyze. And if you like, it quite stands to reason, because a sick animal is not going to have a very nice liver. And so a healthy animal is going to be a good place to build. So so it stands to reason. And the interesting thing is that each part of the liver had a different sort of name of a different gate, if you like. And that was another interesting clue, because I started to compare that to a city plan. And on the right there, you've got a very early plan of medieval Norwich. And I was looking at the patterns that are laid out by the streets, and I was looking at this shape here and recognizing that indeed there is a gallbladder-like form. And there's a pattern of streets. Each time I look at these and compare them with the line of the streets, I'm thinking, that's very, very similar. It may not be exactly the same, but it's similar. So I'm thinking, someone is casting onto the ground here a copy of the heavens in very simple terms. So, and did they lay Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land? Which was Blake's poem, Septimusic. So here again, we've got on the left the ancient streets of Jerusalem, and I'm looking at the ancient streets of Norwich, and I'm finding great similarities to the way the street system is laid out. And I'm looking at the most sacred parts of Jerusalem and the sacred parts of Norwich, that's sacred Jerusalem, the most sacred Norwich, the cathedral. And I'm looking at the way they're laid out, and I'm seeing great similarities. And I'm thinking to myself, they could be, indeed. Maybe this is the origin. That they were using a liver for extirpacy on the site of Norwich and laying it out in this way. And then I researched further and I found that Jerusalem was envisaged as a circular city with 12 towers, like the 12 apostles, if you like. But interestingly, it's always been thought that the heavens themselves overhead were a form of Jerusalem. And so I'm thinking of this in a way is a kind of parallel thing going on. And here we've got a building that stands, it's called the Guildhall in central Norwich Marketplace. It's a beautiful building with flint facework. And this is an old illustration of the temple in Jerusalem. And I'm seeing great parallels here. And I'm thinking to myself, well, Maybe, just maybe, they did build Jerusalem in England's green pleasant land. And this is some early experiments, again, just so you, to try and lead you into my way of thinking here for this evening. I'm looking at the way Jerusalem was laid out, potentially, as I showed you earlier, like Norwich, as a star chart. So it's very similar. We've got constellations laid out in different colours, and I was drawing them in and referring to a star chart. And on my right here, I was trying to find the parallel streets to Norwich's street plan. So each red line is paralleled by a street in Norwich. So these were parallels. And I'm thinking, yeah, I guess maybe they did cast Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. So basically, the constellations that we're familiar with lie on the ecliptic, which is the circle that surrounds the Earth. And if you imagine that the Earth spins basically on a spindle and is tilted at about 23 odd degrees off the plane of the solar system. So the solar system's like a pancake laid out, and you've got the Earth spinning on its spindle, and you've got the constellations laid out in 12 quadrants around the circle, which we're all familiar with. We've all got the birth sign and all that sort of thing. But within the northern heavens are constellations which are, in this illustration, quite cramped, but all lie within the northern hemisphere. So you've got all the usual constellations of the ecliptic lying around the outside, and you've got things right in the middle. And actually, to transfer that from heaven to Earth, you're thinking, well, it's going to be really crowded, there's going to be an awful lot of lines, and how would you achieve that? So I started to look further afield. I looked at cities all over the world, and I found that very often cities seem to have been laid out like this. And every time I looked at a city, I could pick it apart. I could see the constellations laid out in the street patterns. I could understand how it had been done. And even you would find churches attributed to particular saints or you know, that you could see their antecedents in the constellations. And then I started to look at landscapes. And this is the zodiac of Dendera, which was on a ceiling in the temple of Dendera in Egypt. And this is supposed to be, I think it's just early Ptolemaic, but I'm really not sure. But anyway, it was removed and it's been taken to Paris and it's in the Louvre currently. What I found was, and you can see here, underneath, in this area, you can see there's a trace laid over a map. And this is my tracing over an aeroplane flight chart. And what I've done is I've transferred the zodiac of Dendera to the Nile Delta. And I found that it fitted so beautifully. I found such correspondence along the coast, and I found throughout all the water systems, I realized that actually the Nile Delta functioned as a terrestrial zodiac. So maybe we're not surprised, because Egypt's so incredible. The whole place seems to be a temple. So in this discourse of Hermes Trismegistus to Asclepius, do you not know, Asclepius, that Egypt is an image of heaven? Or to speak more exactly, in Egypt, all the operations of the powers which rule and work in the heavens have been transferred to the earth below. Nay, it should be rather said that the whole cosmos dwells in our land, as in its sanctuary. So I think that's a really obvious and clear statement, although these writings were probably for only initiates. But he's a clear statement here. He's saying, look, we have a sacred temple that's set out as the heavens. So what I'm talking about here this evening is a tradition that dates back potentially thousands of years. It's been completely overlooked because we're like ants walking around in it. We cannot be aware of it until the arrival of Google, of course, which was a fantastic new development for everybody. But on the left here, you can see this is a sacred icon from ancient Egypt. And we, you know, if you know, it's about Jeb and Shu and Nut, and I think that sphere is called Tefnut in the middle, but basically earth and sky and where they meet. I mean, if you forget for a minute that this is actually a picture and think of it as a map, you can see the coast of Egypt and the Nile centrally. And what I did here is I just was playing around. This is all about visual play, and that's how I discover things. This is my research. It's the way I play with pictures. And what I've done to the right there is I've laid that on top of a map of Egypt. So it's a very confused image, but I'm not fazed by confused images. I've spent a long time working in art schools, and we used to draw drawings on top of each other's drawings. Sometimes in a life drawing, I'd get a life drawing session, I'd get students to draw all morning on the same page. And you could still see the quality of observation in their drawing and the quality of their drawing. So in this picture, you can see the coast of Egypt is actually Nut's belly, and Jeb is down here, all indicated by watercourses and features within the land of Egypt. So we've come finally to talking about the Stonehenge zodiac. So I thought, oh, come on. At some point I thought, we've got to find something around Stonehenge. There must be something there. I mean, why would they put Stonehenge out on that plane? What's it doing there? So I thought there must be some sign that there is a pattern in the area. And I began to look. And the more I looked, the more I found. And the more I found, the more I found. And this is a snapshot of the middle of the maps, which I eventually laid out, some 16 maps, which all correspond with constellations on the ground. You can see here the tail of Cygnus. And what I did with Ordnance Survey maps, I thought, how am I going to make these pictures? How can I bring them out? Because I can see them. So I started to trace around the edge with a pencil, and then I lightened the middle of the constellation so that I could still see the map. So I used a sort of gouache, and I just wish-washed over the middle and drew around the outside edge. And I said, okay, and what I did, I used field edges, I used roads, I used features that were obviously established long time. I tried to ignore things like railway tracks, of course, and contemporary roads. But I found organic forms. I wasn't looking for ley lines. And of course, I was looking around Stonehenge, which is about here in this plan of maps. And what I found at Stonehenge, they'd be scratching my head. But first, let's have a look at constellations that I was finding. So this is Sagittarius. And interestingly, as I was drawing these out, I was finding smaller versions within the larger version. And it was almost like they had their own life and had been redrawn. So for instance, Sagittarius, which is actually one of the constellations of the astrological circle, it seemed to have been drawn three times in its childhood, in its adolescence, or in its full life, and in its old age. And the only one I've actually got illustrated here is the one in full age, like the the painting here, which is a fragment of the Caprarola fresco, which is in the Villa Farnese in Italy. So I found this lovely painting, and I'll come to that in a minute. But It was a complex form to pick out of the landscape, and there are lots of choices to be made, but I could see it was happening. And when I found things like this wreath replicated on the landscape, I knew I was onto something here, and I had to find more of it. And this is Ophiuchus, And you can see his hand up here is reaching towards Stonehenge, which is about there. And so this is the figure of Osiosus. He actually touches the, you can see this line travelling across here is the line of the ecliptic that travels through the constellations. And some people say, well, he maybe should have been a 13th constellation, because he does touch the ecliptic, and he's quite an important, significant figure. And he wrestles a serpent. And you've got the Lyre of Orpheus, which I'll come to just here. Just here is Hercules, upside down. You can see Hercules with his shield. And so you see there is a correspondence between this painting, the Caporola fresco, and the landscape. And I'm thinking, wow, well, you know, they seem to be so similar. Because what I wasn't finding a circle, like I showed you earlier, we were talking about things being circular to do with the heavens. I was finding stuff laid out in a most unusual way. And this is Virgo. And you can see that the cup crater here, and the bird corvus, and here the head of Chiron, and she's there. And that's what she looks like in the painting. And here's what she seemed to me at that point, referring to maps. This is what Virgo looked like. And here is what I was looking at in Stonehenge. I was finding something bird-like with very long wings. And I was thinking to myself, it's very strange. And I found that ancient Arab scholars used to refer to it as an eagle. So here it's depicted in this 15th century painting as kind of part eagle, which you might think of as Zeus, and part lyre. So the Lyre of Orpheus. So I'm thinking, well, here's Stonehenge down here touching the tail of the lyre. So that would be about here. I'm thinking, wow, so Stonehenge is something to do with the Lyre of Orpheus. So what does that mean? So I thought, well, there's a very bright star in the Lyre of Orpheus, and it's called Vega. Now, interestingly, Vega was a pole star, right? A long time ago. A very long time ago. And this is the landscape around Stonehenge. So if you just look at this Google Earth picture, we're up here at 2 kilometres, I think that's... that represents 2 kilometres on the ground. So I don't know what range they're actually in terms of height. But you're looking at it yourselves, and perhaps you can see a bird and its wings. And you start to think, well, if I drew it, how would it turn out if I was to draw this bird in myself? And there it is, laid over it. Different, I grant you, but nevertheless, I'm satisfied that this one constellation gives me the relationship of all the other constellations, because they have relationship. So when I'm looking at any other constellation in that landscape, I can go to it and I can refer to it. And I say, well, if that one's there, then that one must be here. Oh yeah, so that looks like that. So I began to draw out the map very carefully. And here's another snapshot of my map on the right, my ordnance survey map, and here we've got Aries, and we've got Pisces, and we've got Cetus the whale. And you can see that I very strongly, you've got the lamb, and you've got just off to the right, which is actually Taurus, and here Andromeda, I believe. So in this map, we've got Avebury, and this is the dragon. So Avebury's somewhere here, and the dragon here is found upside down. So this seemed to be the form that the dragon took in the Avebury landscape. Now, interestingly enough, Draco also had a very bright star that was a pole star. Alright, I keep referring to the pole stars, and we'll come to that in a minute. Okay, So this is Bootes. And he has a spear, and there's a crown, and a very straight road. Unfortunately, the map's a bit creased. It's a bit difficult for you to see, but there's a very straight line here, which I see as representing this. And I drew it in, and I painted it, and it seemed to really help. And it had the relationship to the other constellations. So I was satisfied that there was something going on in this landscape. And here's the landscape from Google. And I'm looking at this, and here's something else. I play around, I take wild cards, and I do things outside the box. I want to know, what does it mean to me? And what I saw in this was something quite strange. And I said, this really reminds me of something. And it linked to a picture I've seen from a cave drawing of a shaman. And I dropped it on. You remember this picture? I'm sure that most of you who are interested in cave art will have seen this picture. It's a shaman. And it's an extraordinary image. And it's supposed to be a shamanic picture of a sort of a medicine man from thousands and thousands of years ago. And I could see this in this landscape. I could just see it. But this is where Bootes should be. So I put Bootes there. And for me, that's where Bootes lives. But I thought to myself, maybe that shamanic image was a forerunner, an astrological forerunner of Bootes. And I thought, why not? And I can see right up there, the head of the bear. There's a piece of the bear there. So there seems to be quite a pictorial bit of bear there. Anyway, we'll move on. And the next slide is Cygnus. Again, it's one of my drawings in the Ordnance Survey, and you can see Cygnus and its relationship to Stonehenge, or the Lyre of Orpheus. And up here is King Cepheus, and we'll come to him. Now, the interesting thing about Cygnus is it also had a pole star 17,000 years ago, and so did Cepheus. And I'll explain what happened. But this is my image of the swan. I dropped on and stretched it so that it fell, because the image of the landscape here is slightly distorted due to view. And that's a landscape which is off to the northwest of Stonehenge. And it's a very, very sort of chalky landscape. And this is at Glastonbury, somewhere the Tor is there. And this is, of course, Orion, which I've taken from a traditional star chart. And he seems to appear over at Glastonbury, right next to Taurus. So Glastonbury Tor seemed to be Taurus's eye. And that fits into the chart as well. That's where it should be. Okay, there's Taurus, and there's Glastonbury Tor up there. And a very traditional picture from the Henja Doru, one of the cylinder seals. I don't think they've translated these signs on these seals, and they're not really sure what they were for, but it does look like Taurus to me. And that, again, is from the Caprarola fresco in Italy. So, just want to hesitate here, because this is, you're all still awake, folks. This is a really important thing. I want you to recognize and spend a little time with this, because without the landscape underlying it, we can really see what's going on. I'm convinced that the landscape across the whole West Country is laid out exactly like this. And what's happened here is the painter in the 15th century drew a line along here to indicate the ecliptic. So he actually took the projection, he made the picture fit. So he took this line and he spread it out, or was it already done for him? Was he referring to something much more ancient? And up here, you can see, here is where Stonehenge would lie on the tail, and that star would be Vega. Okay, that star would be Vega, but that would be 12,000 years ago that that star was important. And then the star would move on to Hercules, about his knee. It would move on to Draco. This is how the pole star works. It slowly moves its way around. Then it goes on to Cepheus, Alpha Cepheus, the crown of Cepheus, and to Cygnus. So if you imagine the pole star, over a very long period of time, 26,000 years, it's called the precessional year. And I shall explain a little bit more about that. But another important thing to notice here is this ship is the Argo. Now, there's no detail that's painted in this painting that isn't replicated in the landscape of England. All right, it all lies there, including these mythical images. This is Zeus firing, or I think this is Jupiter firing thunderbolts. And over here is Phaeton falling out of his chariot. These are all replicated. Now, I don't have the time here to show you each detail of the map, but it's quite extraordinary to think that, you know, whoever painted this in the 15th century, because he was anonymous, he actually must have been referring to something that was much earlier. But it's interesting, the ship, the Argo, because the myth of the Argo is really important, and I'll get there in a minute. But as you recall, that Jason went to Colchis to fetch the sacred fleece from the Grove of Ares. And it's a great myth. It's very long, but it's worth referring to this and thinking of it pictorially. As we go through, I'll refer to that again, and it's very important for the whole image and its mythological connections. So this little fellow is Ganymede, and if you can see here, this is his outline in the landscape, and above him is the area where Stonehenge is, just here. And Ganymede has an interesting myth. And this is a little thing I wanted to show you too. Like I say, I experiment outside the box. And I was playing around with the idea of the Sphinx, because there was a space. And I worked into it. And that's what I found. I found this outline that made me think, well, I've not seen a thing like this. It's got wings, it's got a crown, its eye functions as old Sarum in Salisbury. So it fits into the whole landscape. You've got the constellation of Ganymede I just mentioned up here, and Stonehenge is above him. But it's a Sphinx. I'll come back to that as well if I get the time. So here it is, as it appears in the landscape. I drew around things that appear in Google. And I started to take a new stage in the way I was trying to find this representation by actually drawing onto the Google map. I was able to bring out, if you like, visually, very quickly, what I could see. So, yeah, well, there it is. It's got wings, and it's very sphinx-like. It's got breasts, and it's got a crown, which is called, I can't remember the name of that particular crown, but it represents the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt. Okay, so we'll leave the Sphinx for a moment. Fine, it goes. Right, just a quick word about procession. Okay, so over 25,960 years, that seems to vary a bit, we have this process whereby the Earth wobbles. It slowly wobbles its way in a circular fashion. And this is the path it makes to do with the the northern polar circle and the southern polar circle. So whatever it's doing above the North Pole, it's also doing over the South Pole. So that's where this myth of Jason and the Argonauts comes back in, you see. I'm thinking, well, what's the South Pole? Of course, it's a great white thing, Antarctica. It's rather like a fleece, isn't it? On the top of a mast, which is exactly where Jason put the Golden Fleece on the way home from Pols, where he liberated it from the Grove of Ares. So, as you see, it travels inexorably around, I'll put a little pointer there, give you a sense of its circular rotation, and at the southern end. This is going on the whole time. And it moves, it ticks round at about the rate of 1 degree of the 360 odd degrees. It ticks around 1 degree every 72 years. So it's a very hard thing to spot. And they say it was Hipparchus, a Greek, who discovered it. And there have been various attempts to nail it down to a precise measurement. But some people say that the ancient Egyptians knew about this. I'm beginning to think the ancient English also knew about it. So here it is again, and you can see that this is, if you figure this is the mast of the Earth, and the Earth spinning in this way, this is the celestial equator. It's tipped obliquity, or 23 odd degrees, and that's the way it continues all the time. So as it wobbles, it rotates, and we get this travelling. Now the thing about this pole was it was really, really important to people with a spiritual consciousness. This pole was called the axial pole of the Earth. Now without an axial pole of the Earth, you didn't have a way to heaven. You didn't have a way to hell. You had no way out of Earth. It's like a hole in the middle of a millstone. You had no way of entering the grain into the millstone without the hole. All right? So it was absolutely vital to all ancient cultures that they knew where their axial pole was. And there's the sun rising on the spring equinox. Over 25,000 years, it would slowly wobble its way through all 12 constellations. And there's Sagittarius in the background to give you a sense that a constellation might fall behind. Okay, so the axial pole of the Earth and the sacred workings of immortality. Jason and the Golden Fleece. So, what I'm preoccupied here with is this immortality idea. The idea, how would Stonehenge work if it was a sacred space, a place for relating with the immortals? That's another image from my sketchbook to talk about the 25,920 years of the period. So that's just 1 year. Huge lengths of time. And I realised, because I really wanted to date Stonehenge, I wanted to date the landscape. Who'd done this, why and when? And I couldn't figure it out. One night I suddenly thought, well, what if precession was the clue? What if I could find its age using precession? And I realised that if I could look at the outer constellations, of course it's moving around the outside edge. And, of course, I looked at the constellations, and as I explained, they seem to have been redrawn three times in their youth, in their middle age, and in their old age. It was like the age was born, it grew to maturity, and it slowly grew old and died, like we all do. Of course, it would have to, but it would also be immortal, because one day it would come back round again. Just like the constellations in the central part of the zodiac, the ones I've been talking about that have a pole star that relate to myths, they would be the immortals because they would return. So Stonehenge, represents the lyre of Orpheus. Right, I've established that. 12,000 years ago, it would have a relationship to the landscape. It would not have a relationship 8,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago anymore. It would be history, because there'd be a new pole star, a new Henge, as it moved around. So you know, archaeologists, they say, of course, we found these posts, and we're sure that Stonehenge, we've measured the date, and it's just 3,000 years BC, so that's 5,000 years old. I don't believe that. I'm sorry, but it's 12,000 years old. Or the site, at least, is 12,000 years old. It has to be, because it was the only time it was relevant to the landscape. So there it is, at least 12,000 years old, if not much more. Because what we're talking about here is an eternity machine. We're talking about a machine that ticks with the pace of the processional clock. It's only going to go around once every 25,500 years. So maybe it was from the previous epoch. Who knows? So there it is. And Stonehenge just down here. And you can see the constellation laid out there. And you can see Hercules, which of course would be the next Henge. And you can see Cygnus here. And so I went looking for the other Henges. I thought there's going to be more Henges. There's going to be other places which are sacred as the ages move round. And here's what I found. We start with Stonehenge. That's where the lyre of Orpheus is. Move on to Sidbury Hill, or Figgledee, which is very close by. I'd go for Sidbury Hill because it's got an earth ditch around it, and I'll come to that earth ditch in a bit. Then we've got Avebury. We know how important Avebury is. We also know that it's got another circular earth ditch. It's very important. Crooked Soli. Now, probably a village maybe none of you have ever heard of, but it's there, and it's really important. Because that's our current stone. That's where our Stonehenge should be now. Because our pole is Polaris, and it relates to the Little Bear. And the constellation I found at Crooked Soli, and I'll show you that. Then we've got Melchior, which is the constellation of Cepheus, and when the crown of Cepheus was in fact where the pole was, I think about, I'm sorry, but numbers escape me. I think it must have been something in the order of about 20,000 years ago. So Melchior, by the way, means king's city, which is quite useful, isn't it, really? King's city. And then we've got Eddington, which is at the tail of Cygnus. So that's how it works as a diagram. Oh, if I just need back a second to that Clay Hill Warminster. And that relates to maybe even a different circulation of our year, our processional year. So I'll come to that in a bit. But this again is my drawing freehand over Stonehenge. I thought, well, I can see the bird, I'm going to draw it. And this is what I got. I didn't use a map to guide me, I've used a photograph. And by overlaying this, I've been able to show you now how it looks to me. Interestingly, Stonehenge here corresponds with the cloaca of the bird that maybe lays the egg, the primal egg of the universe, right? The egg that we all came from. Was it chicken or bird? Or what? Came first? I don't know, egg. All right, so, are you still with me here, folks? Yeah? Great. All right, now I wanted to talk about the myth of Ganymede. Okay. It seems to me that Ganymede represents a heliacal rising constellation. He's an immortal. He is kind of, he's reborn, if you like. The myth is Zeus was enamored of a wonderful human youth called Ganymede. He descends from Olympus in the form of an eagle and snatches youth, taking him into his palace. Ganymede is happy to live with Zeus, but Hera, Zeus's wife, is infuriated. Ganymede is placed amongst the stars as a gesture to placate the goddess, and balance is restored in him. But what it also describes is the transfiguration of a mortal human into an immortal. So we're talking about heliacal rising constellations that go around the pole and symbolically are reborn into immortality. So, and each time they're born and die. So that's an interesting idea altogether with the centre. So Sibri Hill, this is the date, 10,000 to 8,500 before present. And that's what it looks like. All right, this is the knee of Hercules. So that would have been the Stonehenge. This would have been the axial pole at that date, and only that date. And it will be again when it ticks round, when the whole wonderful clock, you know, carries on round over the processional year. So that is the henge at that date. And just nearby is a star that seems to be laid into the landscape. And that's just as I have found plans of Hercules carrying a little shield with a star on it. And that's I relate to the constellation of Hercules. And there he is. I've put him upside down because that's the way he appears in the chart. It doesn't make a lot of sense upside down, but I'm keeping things orientated towards the north. It's quite hard to orientate yourself in heaven. All right, so there's the star on the lion's skin that seems to get really important, but that's the pole star. Okay, so there he is. I've dropped him into the landscape. And if I turn that slide on and off, you can get a sense of what I'm using as a guide. Perhaps you can. Some of you may not be able to see that. So, this slide is a Hercules image. If you look at just the landscape, do you see something? Can you see what I can see? If I turn... Sorry. It's getting this slide right. We've got Hercules slaying the Nemean lion to the right. And there was... Apparently the lions were a breed of women that would turn into lions at the last minute and devour the heroes as they came along. So this is Hercules, and he's slaying the Nemean lion. And that seems to appear in the image. If I turn the slide off, he's still there. You can still see him. Because I can see him. I've just done a little service for you to help you see him by drawing him in. Now that isn't a constellation, it's an image. That's a different departure. We'll talk more about those sort of things in a bit. Avebury, Draco the Dragon. 8,500 before present to 4,000. My figures may be wrong, and you may find a much more precise figure for yourselves. But that's the time Avebury was a pole star. And that's the time that Avebury was relevant to the landscape. Only then, and again one day, when the processional year comes round. And there it is. Head to the constellation painted in the Caprarola fresco and the mount. Okay, there's Avery up there, and you can see a lovely little crop circle up there. But that's Avery, and you can see the dragon yourself and the largest earth mound in Northern Europe. And they're all astrologically orientated parts of our landscape. We have to accept that, because the further I go with this, the more it becomes absolutely... There it is, it's right on your nose. And I dropped that photograph in to give you a sense of the scale. Okay, so Crooked Soli, Ursa Minor, the Little Bear. This is the current axial polar hinge, all right? This is where we should be greeting the spring and the summer, and the summer sunrise. This is where it happens. And it's in the middle of nowhere. Just up here. And this here is the bear, the little bear. If I draw him in for a minute, I dropped him in, you can see he's there. And that bear is a hinge. And they've just put a solar farm in nearby. So that's another figure, another way of illustrating the little bear. But you can see, just underneath, there again is the henge, and it's up by his tail, and I've dropped him in on the pretty much the same scale as he appears in the landscape. Okay, and there's an aerial view of the henge. All right? That's our current henge. That's where we should be doing ceremonies or whatever we do to venerate the heavens or each other. But that's got a strong ditch around it. This area is on the map, on the Ordnance Survey, as a strong earthwork. So it's obviously agricultural land, probably in private ownership, I don't know. But if you ask me, it belongs to the nation. All right, so Melchion, King Cepheus, 26,000 years before present. All right, we're talking about huge lengths of time. This is an eternity machine. We have to think eternally because the cycles of the heavens repeat and repeat and repeat. Here he is. We've got Cepheus. I've put them in the same orientation as they appear. You've got the ecliptic running through. And here he is with his cape. And I've drawn him in as carefully as I can to bring out a sense of where he lies on the mapping. All right? At the King's City. And this is the landscape. And up there is a henge, actually. But we'll... What have I done here? Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's again, from the Caporella fresco, and that's Cepheus. And he's... Again, depicted in so many different ways, I actually was able to identify at least two different types of Cepheus drawn in the landscape. Whether they redrew him during one processional year, phase with, about 6,000 or 7,000 years, whether they redrew him every couple of thousand years, or whether he was drawn over a much longer period of time, I've got no idea. And here's a close-up of the henge. You can see the shape of the crown. There it is. And the henge itself. There we go. It's got a lake in the middle. I love the idea of a lake being a sort of entry gate to the netherworld, to the other world. Everything in a lake appears opposite. You look into a lake, it's deep and dark and reflective. You could see yourself only, is it you, is it your alter ego, what's going on? And I always think that waters were actually very sacred to ancient peoples. Rivers, lakes, anything that had a mirrory surface was actually a sacred place. So there you go, that's about 100 metres, I'd estimate that's probably 200, maybe 300 metres across. But that would be the henge. And Eddington, the Cygnus the Swan, 16,000 years before present. OK, Okay, there's my map. There's the painting. The Polestar Denim. Okay, 16,000 years before present. And up here is the tail of the swan. And the whole, its wings spread out. And you can use your own vision there to see it. Or you can use my drawing, which is a bit more wild. We can have a little look a bit closer to the henge. That's the tail of the swan. I'm betting, since we see beautiful feathering here cut into the landscape, I'm betting that actually this henge was about here, because there's actually a very deep ditch cut here, and it's on a very high hill. And I've driven down this road. I was unable to actually stop at the time. I would have loved to have gone and had a look. But thanks to Google Earth, I was able to get pretty close to it. You can see this earth trench here. I'm thinking that this is part of the henge. We need some more research to find out. But that's the view. Thanks to Google Earth, someone went up there and took a photograph for me. And that's the view. Doesn't that give you the feeling of being a swan flying across the landscape? It does for me. I go into that and I feel, wow, I can almost feel it. It's got a tremendous sense of space up there. So Sinbad and the Rock. Now, this is a very strange thing, because I found another swan in the locality. And the myth of Sinbad and the Rock. Are you familiar with the story of Sinbad and the Rock? Well, Sinbad's out sailing with his mates, and they're all doing trade. And they stop at an island. And so Sinbad's wandering around on the island. He gets really sleepy, and he falls asleep. And when he awakes, well, his mates have gone with the ship, leaving him stranded on the desert island. So it's quite a nice place, and he walks around. Then he notices a huge dome. And he goes over to this dome, and it turns out to be a vast egg. It's a flipping egg. So what does he think? Oh my goodness, this is a bird's egg, and it's going to come back in a minute. And I'm going to get devoured, he thinks to himself. And just here is the head of the Rock as a kind of shadow. So what happened is he waited till the Rock returned. And he very carefully tied himself to the Rock's foot. And the bird ascended next morning and took Sinbad with him. He thought, this is the way I can escape. But the bird flew off to another island, and there it descended into a huge valley. And there Sinbad got off and untied himself, and the Rock flew away. But there were gems everywhere, all over the floor. There were thousands of gems. And he thought, well, I'm as rich as ever. But I'll never get up here because the cliffs are steep. I'll never get out of here. And then suddenly, these huge chunks of meat fell out of the sky with ropes tied to them. And they were merchants throwing pieces of meat onto the valley floor to collect gemstones. So Sinbad ties himself to a rope and a piece of meat, and he gets pulled out by the tradesmen. And they get him up out there, and he's stuffed his pockets with gems, and he's as rich as Croesus and free. And he gets away from the Rock. So actually the Rock, that's a little myth that's told about Sinbad. When Cygnus was actually the Rock. And there's the Rock bird. And if you look to the right there, is Clay Hill, which belongs to the National Trust. And there it is. And lo and behold, it's got a trench round it. And we'll get to the trench in a minute, but that's important. So this huge hill is the nest of the Rock bird. Right, mythological. Now we come very nearby to the Andromeda starfield, and I want to tell you about Melchion, and King Cephas of Joppa. All right. So here's the king, and here's my freehand illustration of the king. All right, you've got the crown here with the sacred henge and the star. You've got him holding an orb, which is his orb of power, and his frilly cloak. And he's sitting on the throne, and on his right he's got a bird. Okay, so this is King Cephas, and he's a Palestinian king. Alright? And he's got a wife called Queen Cassiopeia. Alright, Queen Cassiopeia, and he's got a beautiful daughter called Andromeda. Now, when Andromeda reaches maturity, Queen Cassiopeia starts claiming, oh, we are the most beautiful women in all the world. We're even more beautiful than the Nereids, who are the daughters of the Titan. So here's Andromeda, very beautiful Andromeda, holding a feather. That's a feather in her hand. And she's in a very typical ancient Venus sort of form. And this is the head of Queen Cassiopeia. And she seems to be holding something crescent-like, rather like the moon. Very important for women, female symbolism. And so what happens is that so these Nereids go and complain to Poseidon. They say, Poseidon, for goodness sake, Cassiopeia and Andromeda, they claim they're the most beautiful. We are the most beautiful, aren't we? We're immortals. We're daughters of Titan. And, you know, come on, do something about it. So Poseidon says, I will. I'll send some whales to the land of Palestine, and I'll despoil their countryside. And so that's exactly what he did. And the whales turned up, and they started splashing everything and making a right mess. And so, what could King Cephas do? He went and he talked to the oracle. And he said, Oracle, what can I do? And they said, well, you've really angered the gods. You know, you have to sacrifice your daughter. You have to tie Andromeda to the coast. You must tie her up and let the whales have her. And that's the only way you'll placate the gods. And so King Cephas goes home and says, oh, God, I'm going to have to tie... I don't want to tie Andromeda up. And the people say, you must, this is the only way you can stop destroying our countryside. You know, it's you angered her, you've got to tie her up. So they tie her up on the coast. And there's actually a chain of little villages there. That's rather like a chain to me. Anyway, so just at the moment of her sacrifice to the whales, whoops, that's a Venus for you to see, a similar Venus. Just at the moment of her sacrifice to the whales, along comes Perseus. All right, so Perseus is here with his winged sandals. And Perseus is in the Argo on his way home with the Golden Fleece, by the way. And he sees all this action. He goes over and he says, look, King Cephas, I'll marry Andromeda, and I'll see the whales off. How about that? And he says, okay, yeah, that's a deal. So he leaps into the sky with his winged sandals, and his shadow, very importantly, his shadow chases off the whales. And all's great. And so there's going to be a marriage celebrated. And there he is with Andromeda in the landscape. So there they are getting married. And there are the whales, you can see. In fact, I found two rather beautiful whales. There's the other one. And so they were both seen off at some point by Perseus. And so he's celebrating the marriage. So what happens? What's he got in his pocket, folks? You know, he's just actually killed the Medusa. Mm-hmm. So just over the horizon comes King comes Phineas, who's a suitor of Andromeda's, with 200 men. And this is going to destroy the wedding. So Perseus pulls out of his pouch the Gorgon, the head of the Gorgon. And the 200 warriors are turned to stone. Don't go to stone yet, all right, folks? Because this is the Gorgon. All right, and you can still see it in the landscape without my drawing to help you. Okay, so the Gorgon has turned the 200 men that stand out on the plain to stone. What are they? They're Stonehenge. So this is mythology in action. I like the idea, don't you? That the stones are men. They've been turned to stone by the Gorgon and Perseus. And for her crime of hubris, poor Queen Cassiopeia was set as a heliacal rising constellation. She plunges and falls into the sea in a most ungainly posture, and there she was in the landscape also. So, funnily enough, of course, there's the Argo parked up nearby for the marriage getaway, and that's all great. So, you can see the mast here, and the jib and sail, and in a typical Grecian style boat with, of course, the oak of Dodona, which was bolted to the front of the Argo to guide it. And that's in the landscape. So how the axial hinges may have worked as gateways to the shadow world. All right, I'm going to try and attempt to describe this potential. And I think that the Egyptian model is actually pertinent here, and I'll show you why. There's the model, and I look at this, we know about this, this is the Great Pyramid of Khafre, and a cross-section of it. And we're familiar with these angles of the Grand Gallery, and the King's Chamber, I think it is, and the Queen's Chamber, I think, here. And this is a cross-section with these tiny little tunnels that were actually closed off. But the angles I see time and time again in the Egyptian texts. And I'm thinking, this is a symbol of how one would access into another world. To take that angle, for some reason, was really important. And I don't know what it was. Maybe this gallery was something to do with shadows. Maybe they were entering the world of shadows. Because if you can imagine crawling up inside this huge gallery, what are you accompanied by but your shadow? You've got to have a lamp. You can't find your way. You've got to have a lamp. So what moves? I bet there are even pictures on the walls there that haven't yet been photographed. And people haven't researched that, but I would say that that gallery has something to do with shadows. And I'll talk about that a little bit, if I've still got time. Okay, so pathway through to the underworld. And I was looking at the Stonehenge landscape again, and I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, yeah, somehow, this really reminds me of a pyramid. I'm going to take one of my wild card experiments and I'm going to drop a pyramid on there because I can see one here. I can see the angles. What happens when we do that? Okay, so there's a pyramid dropped onto that landscape. And here you can see the desktop of my little computer thing that I've been working on. So there it is, and actually it corresponds bloody well. Not quite here, but I switched it round. With the magic of computers, I switch it round, and then the angles are much closer. And what I find is actually Stonehenge sits smack where the King's Chamber should be. Now, proportionately, if you guys know anything about measurement and the pyramids, they're astonishingly accurate. That's not a mistake. Nor are these roads. It can't be. Geometrically, to get Stonehenge smack there, those roads would have had to have been ancient trackways. They might be metalled now, but what we're looking at here is basically a drawing of the cross-section of the Pyramid of Khufu. Alright? It's a cross-section of a pyramid. Now, it makes sense to me that to walk in a pyramid, to walk these angles, to walk the landscape, is more important than climbing inside some great big stone feature that the Egyptians made. This is happening right now. You can have a procession with you, with the dead. You can cast your shadow, which is your companion throughout your life, where you go. And so to bring your shadow as far as you can is really important. So I went to have a look at the area of the pyramid. And I looked at the road layout here. Do you see this rectangle and the angles here? And I dropped, here's another wild card, I thought, well, I'm going to try this because I can. And I dropped the pyramid on the outline. And what I found was so damn close to those angles, I'd say that before they built the pyramids, which are here, the roads were there. The roads were important processionary pathways. And it was the processions with the dead that were important. So the flat pyramid was the precursor to the three-dimensional wonders that we all talk about nowadays. And I'm looking at this, there's so many angles within that that area that are exactly the same as are found in a cross-section of the Pyramid of Khufu, that it can't be just an accident. It must be the case that these were in processional pathways. Which brings me back to England. What are the symbolic figures in the landscape? I found this. This is crazy, and I just want to spend a moment with this, all right, because Stonehenge is here, up on the brow of this elephant, all right, but I want you to see this little tusk, right? This little tusk, this is a gomphorothoe. This comes from thousands of years ago. You can identify with the angles of the tusks. This elephant. An elephant in the English countryside. We'll talk about elephants in a minute, but I'm looking at this. I love the idea of an elephant with Stonehenge as the star on its brow. Okay, well, that's a wild one. I don't know what it quite means. Okay, this bird is Horus in the landscape, always accompanying the king. And if I turn it off, you can see this bird is very, very like the Horus. So we're looking at kind of figures that might be in the landscape of the Duat of the ancient Egyptians, and we're finding them in the English landscape. Okay, so it brings me to a nearby constellation. And this is a little myth I want to tell you about. And this is King Arion, who, here he is. Okay. Now, King Arion was a very wealthy king. All right, you can see he's carrying his purse here, and he's got a sack of money on his back. He was a very successful poet, actually. Now, he went to sea, and he was traveling. And the crew get up against him and say, look, King Arion's got loads of loot. Let's kill him and dump him overboard in Orbivich. Great plan. But King Arion says, oh, well, hold on a minute. Hold on, before you kill me, at least let me sort of sing one more little dirge before I die, please. And they say, okay, man, you sing your song, and then we'll kill him. So he started to sing a beautiful poem, and he attracted a dolphin. And the dolphin came close, and just when they were going to set upon him and cut his throat, he threw himself overboard with all his wealth. And you know what? The dolphin came up close and saved him and towed him to land. Now, just two things before I move on to the next slide. This is tummy button. Here is an earth circle. All right? And there's another one over here somewhere. I can't quite see it. I've lost it. It's somewhere there. Believe me, there are two. So here is the dolphin, Dolphinus. Okay. He's a beautiful picture. Without my drawing on top, you can still see him. And interestingly, just here, his Clark is a third circle, and he's got teeth. I just think it's really nice because it goes with the myth. And right, so going across, seeing across the river of darkness. So, yeah, it all goes dark. Hold on a minute. Okay, are you all still with me? Still awake there at the back? Everybody can hear. Okay, great. All right, so we're up in Norfolk with this picture. This is Warren Fort. Now, I was there this spring. The sunlight was wonderful. And this is completely deserted most of the time. It's a fantastic earthwork on a pretty huge scale. And I was walking around the perimeter. I was just walking along one of these walls here with my wife. And something very extraordinary happened. This. It was an immersive moment. I looked across and my wife said, "Go, look, there's our shadow." And it really was. Because in an instant, you lost any awareness of the outer world, and you were immersed in the land of shadow. And I realized this, that the trench between the two walls is a kind of field of darkness. And on the far side, we were actually communicating with our shadows. I can't express to you this kind of revelation. That's what they were about. That's what these earthworks are about. Everywhere. They're not hill forts. That's the perception the archaeologists have foisted onto us. They're shadow theatres. These things, we call them theatres, but actually, these people were interacting with their shadows. They were interacting with the other side. And there it is, me and my wife, just in that moment. Such an extraordinary thing. And I can't express to you the strangeness of it. And I actually found these flints on the same day. I picked these up. And the strength of black and white contrast in all their material is quite extraordinary. And I thought, that's what's going on. They're making offerings to the other side. These flints aren't weapons. They're offerings. And in the days when that earthwork was fresh, it would have been nearly white. It wouldn't have grown grass all over it. It would be such high contrast that it would be quite shocking to come from a green countryside to a white-walled, chalk-walled sort of theatre, and to actually interact with the other side. So we're back at Stonehenge here. Stonehenge without the stones. Now, if you ask me, and I've done laying out of buildings, the only way you would do a circle like this is without stones. They get in the way. Right, to lay out an earth ditch like this, you can't have stones there. All right, so maybe they laid it out first and then they put the stones there, I don't know. But the important thing is that although the ditch is quite a lot of it is filled in now, that was the important part of Stonehenge. So whether it was in fact that the stones were put there later, I don't know. But for my money, this is the important bit of Stonehenge. This is the sacred relationship with the other world. And what do we find at every hinge point? We find a deep ditch capable of casting a strong shadow. That's to do with King Arya. A very, very deep ditch incision. Hercules. Cepheus. Reflection, water, possibly a ditch. Cygnus, a ditch, although very filled in, to a large extent lost. Maybe they used the spread of the feathers as theatre, who knows. Avery, a powerfully deep ditch. These are the shadows. We relate through shadows. They're so animated. I would recommend you take the next time you're in a place like this, just a few minutes, let's hope the sun's shining, and muck about. Because it's amazing. And that's at Salisbury, that one. So that's the Eye of the Sphinx, by the way, that I took a chance on. And that's at the foot of the rock bird, or Cygnus, if you like. Okay, so upscale and deep into the underworld. Now this is where things get a bit tricky, because I'm now going to depart from astrological and I'm starting to look at pictures and symbols. Alright? I don't know how much time I've still got.
You've got 10 minutes.
Oh, I'm going to have to speed up, guys, because we've got so much to cover. Oh dear. Right, okay. So, right. Let's skip that one. Orpheus and Eurydice. This is the myth that relates to Stonehenge. And I'll show you why I believe that. Okay, because of the harp. Okay, this is the moment that Orpheus receives the harp from the gods. Okay, he's there depicted in the landscape. If I turn him off for a moment, you can see him. You can see the harp. And here he is, striding forward with the harp, with Persephone here, who reaches her hand out here to pluck the harp. This is the harp. This is Orpheus. This is his hand out to one side. He's holding the harp. She's plucking the string. She's being touched by Orpheus's plea to free Eurydice. Now, if you don't know the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, I'm just going to quickly run through that, is that Orpheus is one of the crew of the Argo. He falls in love with beautiful Eurydice. She's bitten by a snake. She falls. She dies, of course. So Orpheus, who's a fantastic poet, decides he's got to go and fetch Eurydice back to life. So he descends into the underworld and he pleads with Pluto and Persephone to return his love. And so he's in the underworld. And this is Pluto, who looks like quite a character. And you can say I took some artistic license here, but that's what it looks like. And you've got a little bit of the previous drawing here. You've got Persephone and Orpheus's lyre there. But this is Pluto. And Stonehenge is somewhere down here. Okay, and that looks like Osmodius there in the background. But it's not a very good drawing. Anyway, okay, move on. So here is this thing looked like a butterfly to me. I took a chance of translating it in that way, and that's what it looked like. It's I would say this is a kind of depiction of a spirit. And then I thought, this is a spirit, so what are we talking about? If it's depicting a spirit, well, why? Why put it there? Of course, we're thinking about Orpheus and Eurydice, and they're in the other world. And this is where I started to think about the sacred book of the dead. And I got Isis here with these horns are Isis Hathor, which, you know, this is how I'm sort of translating these things. I'm saying, okay, well, these horns, they remind me of Isis, okay. So there's some sort of a gesture there, a very large hand pointing to Isis, and she's here in her regalia, and there's a dancer to the top here as a little funny angle, which you probably can't, you may not be able to pick that out. But in the next slide, which is just to the west, this is a dancer who appears to be holding out some small figure. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? And I can see there's cows here. So I'm thinking, Isis, kind of something symbolic here? What's really happening? It seems like this is a dancer, a temple dancer. And in the next slide, I'm really rushing through this stuff. Okay, so I'm having to translate this pretty quickly. This is the sail of a boat. Here's the hull. Okay, there's there's the prow of the boat. It carries the soul. Here is the Djed column. Very recognizable as an Egyptian Djed column. Okay, this is the sacred... on here is the sacred bird of Hathor, all right, which is Isis again. This is a sarcophagus. I'm thinking chrysalis. This is metamorphosis. Of course, it happens every day in the countryside in England. We find chrysalises. We find butterflies. It's metamorphosis. That's what we're talking about. So we're looking at the butterfly, and it's telling me the story. The soul comes to be reincarnated through the chrysalis into the new butterfly. It's like the sacred book of the dead. And below it is Apophis, the snake and the dog. And if I turn that off, you can try and read that for yourself. But that's what I'm getting from this landscape. And there is the sacred bird of Isis, which you can see in this little area here. Okay, on with the next slide, a map of the underworld and the field of rushes. Now this looks like a Paul Flay drawing, and I like this drawing more than anything, personally. But it is an important piece of the landscape. It's to the north of Stonehenge, and I'm going to start picking out bits very quickly. This is a staircase, these are pyramid-like forms. Here is a crocodile, there's a snake, okay, there's a sort of weird snail-like character here, there's an S-like form, and there's something that looks like a funny kid's house here, but all these are given to me by indicators in the landscape, which I've just drawn over, and strangely enough, there's a sacred map that was included in sarcophaguses, and it was called the Field of Rushes. And it was a map given to the dead for them to guide their way around the netherworld, the Field of Rushes. And here is another one, which has exactly the same symbols. We've got the crocodile, which is here, all right? We've got, just here, unfortunately, out of slide, you've got this character, which is Happy. And that represents the Nile. And you've basically got the S there, this wonderful S-like shape. They were separate islands. And there was always a boat. And there is a boat. This is the hull of the boat with the mast. And it's upside down. So all these figures and all these items are found in the landscape to the north of Stonehenge. All right. And that's a map of the dead. Map of the Field of Rushes. And finally, the Lake of Fire. Okay, so this is Stonehenge in the middle. Again, so what we've got is we've already talked about the Lyre of Orpheus, And this is another figure on a slightly different scale, but it doesn't negate the stuff that's already found there. It's just a different way of interpreting what's there. So this is a sacred lake that lies in the temple grounds of every temple in Egypt. And here in England, we have a very similar thing. And these are figures. If I show you a depiction of the sacred lake, which is called the Lake of Fire, which is supposed to be the primordial lake, which is reenacted with every sunrise at dawn. You see the sacred egg of the sun coming up above the horizon, and the fields looking like fire. And you can just imagine, these figures are what I'm interpreting as these monkeys, or thoth-like figures. Okay, guardians of the gateway, the sphinxes. I think we'll skip these really pretty quickly. They're sphinx-like figures, which are in the locality as well. I'll just whip through them because I'm going to skip this just so that we can get to a final slide, which I'd like to talk about. The weighing of the heart. Now, if any of you have studied Egyptology at all, you will have come across the weighing of the heart, which is about the idea that we all actually have to meet our karma after we die, and that the heart is weighed after our soul has taken it to the other side, and we're met by this ultimate judgment, which is the weighing of our heart. And if it's not found in agreement, this first slide is the soul being carried across, and that's Chiron here, who's the oarsman rowing a bark across. I'm taking to be the soul. This is my interpretation. You may have your own, but that's the way I'm seeing it. And this next image is the weighing of the heart. Now this is I think it's called I think he's called Amun. He's this kind of a weird character who's half crocodile, kind of monster, and he eats hearts. If your heart isn't found pure by the weighing, then he's there ready to eat it. And that's your lot, I think. But this is Mart, she seems to have, this is her hair, that's her profile, and this is her feather. I'm interpreting her as Mart because that's truth. This is, I'm trying to remember the name. I think he's called Knum. He's a figure that has horns, and he's here presiding over the weighing of the heart. This is Thoth, who's sitting on a stool, and he is controlling the weighing scale. And here is, I'm assuming that this is actually Isis in two forms, the netherworld form and the sort of real world form, if you like. So this triangle is this kind of axis, and this is the weighing spar. That's the way I'm seeing this. And up here, the previous slide of the soul being carried across to the other world. So I can feel I'm having to come to the end here. And that is the weighing of the heart in the Egyptian tradition. And you've got all the same characters. You've got this weird crocodile character who devours the heart. And Thoth and Anubis. And Horus, maybe this is Horus, I'm not sure. But so there you go. I think this is the last slide. You'll be very relieved. All right. This was quite wild and ridiculous. And I don't know what to make of this, but you can scratch your heads over it on your way home. So this is Durga, or Mata Durga, as she's called in India. And she is here slaying the bull demon. All right? She rides the tiger. In some pictures, she's depicted as standing on the tiger. She's multi-armed, giving aspects of her sort of creation and destruction balance that she seems to... She's a creation goddess. All right? Now, this is Castle in Churhill Downs in Oldbury Castle. And what I found here was really weird, because I began with this, oh my goodness, this is sort of a tigery thing, and let's draw this. That just looks weird. What's like that? What rides tigers? And I looked it, and I looked for it, and this is what I found, Mata Durga. And I said, well, if this is the case, if this is Mata Durga, then where's the bull demon? Well, actually, below is the bull demon. In the landscape directly below is the bull, and little people being destroyed around her. I don't know what that is, but here's the tigers on which she rides. She's up here. So you can see the whole panoply there of Durga slaying the bull demon. Now, whether there was some sort of Hindu kind of influence going on, I don't know. But, you know, maybe one day we'll all find out. Okay, Andy, I think I've run out. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, there we are. There's some new stuff, and I think we're going to hear a lot more about that. So thank you ever so much for coming along. I'm sorry it's a bit cold in here tonight. We're still getting used to thermostats, which is where they are, but we'll learn that for next time. But thanks for coming along, everybody. We'll be back here 18th of September, where it'll be me doing crop circles and other things. And don't forget to get your copy of the information as you go out. They're on the table. Thanks for coming, and another big hand, please, for... Yeah.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.